Trackless Thread, Chapter 6. Immediately after the engines cut, a lot of noises filter in. The high whine of the Iron Man armor powering up, Steve yelling, guns, someone telling Clint to release the bus before they're forced to shoot. May is glaring at him still, and under almost any other conditions, Clint would respond or move or say something. Except behind her, through the glass, he sees the cockpit door open and Coulson walk in looking confused, his mouth moving, before he looks up and right at Clint. Clint read that the perception of time changes depending on the body's metabolic rate, because Shield Medical is profoundly terrible, and sometimes your only entertainment option is stealing the fringe science journals your RN worryingly reads. So they said that maybe as you get older, time seems to move faster around you, blurring away from the infinite summer afternoons of being 9 years old, when the prairie winds rose up and Clint stuck his head out the back of the circus truck like the mutt he's always been. They said that the world, to smaller animals, seems to move much slower. And since Clint has always felt fucking tiny next to the hugeness of everything he'd let Coulson become to him, it makes sense that Clint stares into the guy's slate-blue eyes for maybe a year, maybe a decade, and that to everybody else, it would last all of 2 seconds before some secret agent Kendall in BDUs shoots Clint with a ray gun. Clint wakes up, racked with full-body regret, trapped inside a room made of inside-out Duplo blocks. He must be on Coulson's jet, because Stark's plane had been swank and shady as hell, but nowhere during the extensive tour had Stark mentioned an interrogation room / torture chamber. They haven't handcuffed him to anything, but someone, fucking May, Clint bets anything it's fucking May, had left him splayed like one of Jack's French girls on the freezing metal table. Fuck, Clint says to the Duplo ceiling. 5 minutes later, when he's using the jagged metal edge of the chair, what remains of the chair, to carve at what might be a structural weakness in the room, the intercom crackles to life. "Hello, Agent Barton," an English girl says. "You're not in any danger," comes a Scottish voice, male. "The night-night gun was designed to disable, not cause permanent harm. If you're feeling any palpitations, in upwards of 60% of cases, they go away within 72 hours. Clint ignores both of them. He keeps scraping away at the wall. Mostly, it's guessing, because he knows fuck all about this jet. In the briefings, it looked boring to fly, and too big for most of the stealth work he and Natasha count on as their bread and butter. "Clearly," the girl cuts in, "we understand this is a stressful and confusing time, and we appreciate your patience. If you could just answer the following questions on the scale of 1, not at all, to 5, extremely, it would be helpful in having us determine how to proceed." Underneath the Duplo block covering is some sort of metal he can't seem to make a mark on, not even with the steel bones of the chair. He bets this is alien shit, and Clint feels one of those hot flares of anger at the thought that 15 years of towing the line and taking gut shots for S.H.I.E.L.D. left him fucking here, locked in an interrogation room in a plane that's been deemed need to know. He keeps seeing Coulson's fucking face through the pilot's window of the jet. And fuck his eyes, because that means he sees the reflection of his own face too. Crushed, bloodless, completely exposed. Clint thinks he probably still looks like that. Like someone had taken a scalpel and peeled back the skin of his chest and cut away the muscle and sawed through the bone, until his bruised and busted heart was there in the open for Coulson to reach in and rip it out of its place. The English girl says, "Do you experience repeated and or disturbing memories, thoughts, or images from a stressful experience in the past? 1 to 5. There's a static noise, and then the protest of, "Sir!" muffled through fabric, before the buzzing sound of the door lock sounds, and fucking Coulson steps into the room. On the intercom, May's voice rings out. Don't try anything, Barton. If she says anything else, Clint doesn't catch it. Coulson is closing the door of the Duplo room behind himself, neat and contained as he's ever been. Clint just stares, hungry for the details. The unfamiliar tie, the tailored lines of Coulson's suit, the wrinkles around his eyes and mouth. Everything about him is different and exactly the same. Coulson looks as composed as ever, but older now, too, a meticulously crafted weapon, still dangerous after long use. And Clint wonders if that's how this happened, if maybe Fury didn't have the heart to let go of this gun. Clint wants to say a whole bunch of stuff. It all gets jammed up against each other in his throat, like Coulson shouted, "Fire!" in the proverbial movie theater. "Barton," Coulson says out loud, finally. "It's worse than shouting fire." Clint doesn't say anything. The entire first month he was at S.H.I.E.L.D., he hadn't said anything, beginning as a desperate bid to avoid self-incrimination and evolving rapidly into cussedness. Coulson has the fucking audacity to cock an eyebrow and say, "This is the quietest I've ever seen you." By the time he'd met Coulson for the first time, Clint was mostly known for never shutting up. "You fucking asshole!" tumbles out of Clint's mouth, finally, the hard consonants and angry scrape of teeth against his bottom lip. Instead of getting pissed, or being an inscrutable dick and making Clint scrub out a fucking toilet with a toothbrush, Coulson just smiles tiredly, like he's missed this. He says, "Quiet. There you are." It's hard. It hurts. It feels like he has to push through a wall of skin and bone to get it out. But Clint says, "I was here the whole time. Where the fuck were you?" He stares at Coulson's face and wonders if he's an LMD, if he's a clone. "Fury told us you died." "I did," is Coulson's answer, light and noncommittal, and he rests a hip against the table. "Are you a clone?" Clint asks, because fuck, he lives a terrible goddamn life where that's a real question he really has to ask. Coulson's smile gets crooked. "No, and I'm not an LMD either." Clint believes him. Or, anyway, Clint thinks he believes. He's met a baker's dozen of clones in his time at S.H.I.E.L.D., and there's always something missing in the eyes, the tilt of the head. The small details and presentations are always perfect, but from a distance, there's always something off. It makes R&D fucking bugfuck. It makes them start reading paranormal fringe journals looking for the stuff of the soul. The LMDs are even worse. Personality programmable, but static. They're the perfect snapshot of a singular moment in time, but they never change. The androids Clint has met are more convincingly human. Curious, fickle, possessive, petty. "How then?" Clint asks, and watches Coulson's face go serene with detachment. It's the expression of a man who's trained himself out of his reflective flinch so well that his tell is being excessively placid. Clint stumbles, realizes he doesn't actually know if it's okay that he's seen what he's seen. But then he decides, fuck it. Because Coulson's evidently been faking his death like they're all living in a post-shower episode of Dallas. "We saw pictures of some kind of procedure." "How much of it did you see?" Coulson asks, like he's just idly interested. "Too much." "Not a lot," Clint says. "Natasha and Cap had to break into White Plains." "I leave an icon of integrity and truth with you for less than a year, and you have him breaking and entering?" Coulson murmurs. But his grin is back. This isn't the way Clint saw this conversation going down. "Seriously, what the fuck is going on?" Clint bites out. He starts to dig his nails into the meat of his palms to keep from reaching out and grabbing Coulson, to keep from shoving him into walls and putting hands on him, to testify that he's real and really there, with the solid mass of a person breathing in and out with the soft tissue of his lungs. Coulson hears something in Clint's voice he hadn't before, or that he's finally listening for now, because his face goes from its poised casual affection to something more tender and breakable. Clint knows that expression from waking up in medical and being pulled out of the jaws of death by his handler, from when he'd found himself ready to go on his knees and beg that Shield give Natasha the chance they'd given him. In the years Clint has known Coulson, he's done terrible things and never flinched, because the side of the just sometimes needed someone to be their thin black line, the advance team, the plausible deniability. Coulson always comes back from it. He still remembers people's birthdays and spends most of his disposable income on handmade suits like an asshole, and tells everybody about how the one time Clint and Natasha went to the fucking opera on an op, Clint burst into tears during the second act, and Natasha fell asleep. Coulson is better than perfect. He's real. He touches darkness, but it doesn't keep him. "Don't lie to me, okay?" Clint says. Or he means to say it, but it comes out pleading. "I just... don't fucking lie to me anymore." "I won't. I'm not. I promise," Coulson tells him. The way you say something reassuring, the way he talks to victims, and people who turn on their bosses in Shield safe houses and interrogation rooms when they need a soft touch. "We were waiting until you woke up." "We?" Clint repeats, and thinks about May and Secret Agent Kendall, the English girl over the speaker, and the Scottish voice that had joined her. He thinks that Coulson's got all new people now, probably, that he's run away and traded up. "I thought I should tell you and Natasha together," he says. "After she was finished threatening to shoot off my testicles, she agreed." Natasha threatening to shoot body parts off people has always been weirdly comforting to Clint, and it loosens something in his chest enough so that he can say, "Okay, yeah, let's go find Natasha." Coulson smiles back at him. "Let's go then." Outside the Duplo room, Coulson's plane looks like Air Force One, which Clint knows about a lot, both because once they caught Short Straw and got smuggled in for Secret Service duty, and because Nat has a gross old man crush on President Han Solo. She's made him watch that movie like 25 times. The plane is expensive and nice, with the oppressive quietness of heavy materials and careful construction of no expense spared. It's also weirdly deserted for a relatively small space, so Clint figures this is a sign that everybody involved in this shit show is gathered somewhere, holding each other at gunpoint. "Nice plane," Clint says stupidly. Coulson reaches up, runs a hand down one of the paneled walls of the plane. He grins. "The bus. She's all right." Clint is busy processing that and wrinkling his nose, because bus monitor, when they cross some threshold and come across a glassed room overflowing with angry Avengers and secret agents. There doesn't appear to be any blood flowing, and the safety on everybody's gun still looks engaged, so the situation is significantly less terrible than Clint had anticipated. Coulson pushes open the door, and by way of introduction, he points his way across the huddle of new people, clustered close together and slightly behind May, who looks even more like cold murder than the last time Clint saw her 3 years ago. "Agent Barton, this is Gemma Simmons." A girl nerd, with a shirt buttoned up all the way, waves, nervous. "Leo Fitz?" A boy nerd next to her waves too. "May, you know." May doesn't wave. May doesn't blink. And Sky. A girl who looks like she fell out of an Urban Outfitters tips her chin up at him.
Hey.
Clint says, sup? Because, okay, sure, why not? There's a long-suffering sigh from the far corner.
Don't
get along, the man says. And when Clint slants his gaze over, he sees it's the asshole who shot him. And that would be Specialist Grant Ward, Coulson says, sounding fucking fond, which reminds Clint he's pissed all over again.
Thanks for shooting me with a ray gun, asshole, Clint snaps at him.
Ward, who looks like he should be folding himself into a pink plastic convertible, except for how he's strapped down with, like, 16 fucking guns, says,
you stabbed the plane.
It's been a very trying few weeks, Natasha cuts in, her voice so even it's unsettling.
And also, up until like 48 hours ago, we thought you were dead, Tony says to Coulson.
His armor's been folded up into a briefcase again, chained to his wrist like the military passes nuclear launch codes. The Iron Man armor's arguably more dangerous.
Pepper made me go to Olive Garden because of you. I bought a park. I commissioned a bust.
Coulson looks neither surprised nor moved. Up until Clint decided to jump out of your plane and stab mine, I was supposed to be dead, Stark.
You have a funny definition of dead, Agent Coulson, says Steve, who's been quietly brooding in a corner up until now.
And that's coming from me.
Horribly, Coulson actually blushes, and Clint takes the opportunity to catch Natasha's eye and stage whisper. The fucking plane is called the bus.
And because she's the greatest love of his life, she gives Coulson her most revolted look and says, nerd? Agent Ward's still armed, Coulson warns them, too embarrassed for mildness. He's also so, so trigger-happy, Urban Outfitters tells them. We haven't let him kill anybody in like 18 hours.
Clint repeats, he shot me with a ray gun.
Yes, Sky retorts, drawing out the syllable. Which you're still alive to complain about. Specialist murdering Kendall continues to look unmoved. None of this is addressing how Agent Coulson is alive, Steve reminds the room at large, and he favors them with his disapproving Captain America look, which Clint hasn't seen in action in months now. It's super effective. And it eventually lands on Coulson again, who is clearly fighting a costly internal struggle against a nerd orgasm that Steve Rogers is frowning at him. Him! Clint's read Coulson's entire fucking cap nerd forum. He's like a profiler. He knows how they think now. Coulson takes a long moment to collect himself, tucking away his towels and smoothing the line of his tie down his chest, before he says, it's a long and shockingly uninteresting story. One I'd like to tell to Agent Barton and Romanoff first.
Bullshit, Tony says, reflexive. Our superhero boy band wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for my jet.
May, whose selective hearing is second to none, says to Coulson, your office? He nods. Thank you. And if you could... She cocks an eyebrow at him and cracks her knuckles. Clint is horrified to realize it still leaves him equal parts scared and half hard in his pants. This is the worst, for so many different reasons, too. And then all that's left is Coulson looking at Natasha, looking at Clint, and saying in that voice he uses to bring people in from the cold, agents, if you'll follow me. There's a lot of stuff fighting for Clint's attention when Coulson ushers them into his office. Tony's starting shit downstairs, Natasha's perfectly blank expression of crippling unhappiness. The fact that Clint is, like, less than 10 feet away from Coulson's bed. So once Coulson closes the door to his office, slash bedroom, Clint just stares at the floor so he doesn't stare at the pillows, the sheets,
the hospital corners like a pervert. This goes on long enough that Coulson says, "I'm surprised neither of you hit me, to be honest." "Clint's too in love with you to hit you," Nat says, "because she's a fucking monster." Coulson slants a look over at Clint, who finds himself stuttering, "That is not true," with such a complete lack of conviction that he wishes that instead of his boomerang arrow and electric shock arrow, he'd pack some kind of tunneling arrow so he could burrow to the center of the earth and incinerate himself out of this lifetime. Nat just goes on saying, "And I'm not confident in my ability to pull my punches enough so that a fragment of your shattered skull wouldn't..." Coulson holds up a hand, his expression a cross between affection and a grimace. "Thank you, Natasha." "You've always liked comprehensive reports," she says, baring her teeth. "Yes," Coulson allows, and looking away from them, he murmurs, "And I owe one to both of you now, too." He goes to the desk, and the way Coulson moves in his own spaces, how he navigates corners, and how his hands shuffle through papers, the way Coulson lowers his head when he's considering how to start a difficult conversation, these things are as unchanging as the universal measures. "I don't remember much immediately after Loki," Coulson grimaces, "stabbed me. I was told that I was secreted away to an eyes-only shield facility after being stabilized, and was subsequently subjected to various surgeries and semi-experimental treatments." "The photos show you dead," Natasha says to him. "For more than a few seconds on an operating table, even." Coulson's smile is wry.
"I know that now."
Clint feels his eyes widen.
"They didn't tell you?" he says.
"They told me I was sent to recuperate in Tahiti," Coulson says, and slumps down into his desk chair, his hands folded in his lap, and looking at some point on the floor between the shined toes of his Italian leather shoes. "I have memories, foggy ones, of a beach hut and umbrella drinks, and massage therapists who were flatteringly flattering about a creaky old man." It's reflex that has Clint saying, "You're not old." And Coulson looks up at him with a crooked smile that's so affectionate, it makes Clint shy. Shyer. It makes up for the way Natasha's staring at Clint like he's an embarrassment, and she's embarrassed to know him. That's fine. He and Coulson can be embarrassing together. "But I felt different," Coulson says eventually, forming the last word, like the nonspecific descriptor is frustrating him. When he talks again, there's something agitated in his voice. Clint and Natasha are cued into that particular tone, into the way it betrays shit going sideways and ops shortly hitting full foobar. "I felt like there was something wrong, more wrong than the usual discomfort of recovery." Natasha says, "You started digging." Like she both understands and is sorry she does. "My files were sealed, to me, by order of the director of S.H.I.E.L.D.," Coulson replies, too casual. "Some level one was nice enough to offer to forward my request to Fury's office and have them circle back to me in the standard 5 to 10 business days." Coulson reaches into his desk and pulls out a manila folder. When he opens it for Clint and Natasha, it's more of the same they'd seen from the file in White Plains. Coulson's dead body in the images, while his living body and living fingers touch the edges of the photographs, the redacted documents. "I pulled some strings. I appealed to Melinda's sympathy," he says, and his thumb is sweeping back and forth over the gruesome split of bone and flesh that Loki's spear had left behind in dead Phil Coulson's chest. Just looking at it makes Clint sick. "I was dead. They brought me back. I just don't know how, or even when. I remember Tahiti, but there's no evidence I was really there. And when I was kidnapped by Centipede,
What? Clint asks. Their ministrations knocked loose a few visuals, Coulson pressed on. That beach hut became an operating theater, and the flatteringly flattering masseuse became a surgeon. Well, from what I can remember, I didn't want to be revived. There's a universe trapped in the grammar of that sentence, Clint thinks, dizzy with worry. And he reaches out, for no good reason, closes his fingers around the edge of Coulson's desk. There are papers and antiques and Coulson's Howling Commandos relics arrayed with care here, framing the photographs spilling out of their manila folder. And Clint looks at them like the careful wards that temple priests used to put around the dangerous and mystic. That doesn't explain why you didn't tell us, Natasha says here. You should have told us, is what she means. We would have helped you, is what she wants Coulson to know. From his smile, he does. You'd become Avengers. You had other things to worry about. I didn't want you to lose focus, he says, in a tone that telegraphs he knows how bullshit this is. Through it all, Natasha's silence becomes increasingly oppressive and exponentially more dangerous. It's a credit to Coulson's testicular fortitude that he keeps talking instead of crossing his legs or running away, or begging Natasha to stop looking at him like that. And, fairly or not, I wish you still didn't know. Clint hears, what? Did you worry we'd embarrass you in front of your new team? And for a few seconds, he almost convinces himself he'd only said it in his head. Then Coulson says, you and Natasha would do anything within your considerable power to save me, even if you shouldn't, Coulson tells them, blunt. My new team isn't so attached. I trust them to do the right thing. It takes Clint a beat, two beats, too long to process that, because Natasha's already catapulted blank staring and horror into fiery anger. Is that what the fucking cavalry is for? She spits at him. To put you down? Coulson's mouth tightens. That's what ward is for, he says. Honest in this, at least. And Melinda hates that nickname. Maybe I hate being called Black Widow, Nat retorts, vicious. We wear what we bought and paid for. We wouldn't have to put you down, Clint cuts in, stumbling at the end. Clint's not dumb enough to believe in love at first sight, but he'd caught Natasha's eyes and hadn't been able to pull the trigger on her. Years and years before that, Coulson had arched an eyebrow at him, crooked a smile at him, and the thought of either of their faces, the way Clint would know them by touch alone, the way they've shaped his years and days and individual hours. At the end of his arrows, or the sight of his rifle, makes something in his stomach turn. When Coulson says, I wouldn't have wanted you to have to make that choice, Clint. It's said so kindly that it makes it worse. That it makes everything worse. Coulson means it. His soft touch has always been a field liability and his greatest asset. Clint thinks he knows how this conversation went in Coulson's head as he turns over the possibilities and angles. He could tell Strike Team Delta, but that would involve Delta. Nat and Clint didn't need extraction plans or hand-holding, but they love Coulson, as well as people like them can love people like Coulson. He's always been the constant in the ever-changing formula for balancing their books. Clint knows he's always been worse about it, more given to clinging and childish acting out. Rough edges, the Red Room had filed off Nat before she'd hit double digits. But even with months of mourning, Clint is less struggling to reconcile the falsehood of Coulson's death than fighting the reality that he wants to stay gone. Clint hasn't even filed an after-action on Loki yet, not a real one. There is a lot Clint needs to tell him. The rest of the conversation's not much better than the first part,
And the more Clint listens to Nat and Coulson argue if the question marks around his return justify his subsequent course of action, the more Clint just wants to be able to fast forward to the end, to the part where they convince him Clint's not too in love with him to hit him in the face, to the part where they decide all of this is really pretty dumb, and Natasha takes him by charm offensive, or actual malice, back to New York City, where Coulson has an account at Midtown Comics, and so much unfinished business. To the part where Clint says, "Hey, so who's Pam?" And Coulson says, "She's not important, Clint. You're important. You and Natasha." "Why do you think it's bad?" Clint asks suddenly. Listens to the crackle in his voice, that's his heart on the fritz. "What brought you back? Why would it have to be bad?" And here, the brittle, solemn lines of Coulson's face break finally. He looks older. He looks tired. He looks like he's had this argument with himself before. Coulson hesitates, and Clint seizes that momentary weakness to say, to insist in a rush, "You coming back is good." But Coulson doesn't make that face, like Clint's unbending stubbornness is winning him over. He just keeps looking worn down. He says, "We don't know how I got here." "Just come back," Natasha says. "We can figure this out." "It wasn't good," Coulson says finally, after the silence has extended out between them for years. "What I remember, it wasn't good." He looks between them, between Clint and Natasha. He looks tired and hurt. "And I can't risk it," he finishes, a rasp in his voice now too. "I just can't risk it." It's a fraught moment, one that hangs suspended there, and Clint thinks he could live inside it forever. Except then the intercom on Coulson's desk jangles, and Secret Agent Kent Dahl says, "Sir, if you want me to keep these assholes down here any longer, I'm going to have to resort to terminal force." Apparently, the threat of certain death at the hands of Ward and May isn't sufficient to keep the Avengers from complaining loudly and at length about being left out. It's terrible, not just because it gets Coulson's hackles up and they have to go down to the belly of the jet again. Natasha laces her fingers with Clint's, and he is reminded bitterly of why group work is terrible. "I'm doing good work here, with my team," Coulson says, which, according to Stark's face, is 0% convincing. A mobile unit was something we'd always wanted to have established for S.H.I.E.L.D. Stark waves away the words. "That's all ninja spy politics, which I don't care about," he reminds everybody. "What I care about is why you and goddamn spy daddy let us think you were worm food this long." "Well, you know, you bought a park, commissioned a bust, went to the Olive Garden. How terrible for it all to go to waste," Coulson deadpans. And as Stark turns a color of red not found in nature, Coulson asks Steve, "How did you get wind of me anyway?" "Oh," Steve says, "either a naturally good-natured or a fucking incredible troll. You can thank Clint for that. He read your entire Howling Commandos forum." Coulson sounds faint. He says, "I see." "Well, you know, Jarvis," Clint says, "and bus monitor. And I mean, oh shit," his brain thinks, even as his mouth is already moving. "Pam and stuff." Together, the nerds on Coulson's new team say, "Pam?" like they've scented blood. Coulson ignores them all. With impressive dignity, he says, "I guess I should say I'm proud of your thoroughness." "But seriously, why?" Stark presses, with a manic urgency that makes his hair and eyes both look crazier.
What's the point? Why would you bother?
Fury's a dick. I get it. Maybe he wanted to use emotional manipulation to get me and Mr. Freeze here to get along and save us from near certain death and possible alien enslavement.
But after?
Afterward, you could have popped out of some recently undead closet and read us in. You could have spared me the indignity of white wine spritzers at Olive Garden.
Presuming to know why Director Fury does anything is always a mistake, Coulson replies, and squaring his shoulders, he adds, and frankly, we were trying to avoid just this type of situation. Stark stares, like he's not registering the clusterfuck of people on a highly classified shield jet, the intelligence nightmare, and crossover risk.
So what? You stayed dead because it was easier? Steve asks.
Less complicated, Coulson corrects, and assiduously does not look at Clint or Natasha.
Wow. Just wow, Tony says.
Initially, I said that Bruce was just being a buzzkill by not being part of this recon mission, but I'm starting to realize his paranoia about going jolly green out here was apparently valid.
Urban Outfitters takes this moment to look up from her laptop and Claire's. By the way, there are like 6 Pams who work for S.H.I.E.L.D. None of them are under 60.
He could be into older ladies, the boy nerd pipes up in a familiar Scottish accent.
He could be like, war. Ugh!
The girl nerd removes her elbow from his sternum and smiles serenely.
So you're okay with this? Steve barrels on to Coulson, eyes on the prize, focused on the mission, Captain America style. You just stay out here on your plane? Give it all up?
Captain Rogers, I was brought back from the dead, Coulson tells him, so painfully sincere that Clint hates Steve all over again.
It was unsettling. Do you really blame me for wanting a little distance?
Steve cracks a grin at that.
Well, when you put it that way, he allows.
Maybe Pam is a nickname, Urban Outfitters is mumbling to herself.
The only thing Pam is a nickname for is Pamela, or Pam, Kendall mutters.
Clint looks at Coulson's new crew and wants to shout at them that they should shut the fuck up with their smug fucking faces. Do they know Coulson's only staying here because he thinks they'd take him out? Because Coulson knows Clint and Natasha too well to believe that they'd make the same call here? That they wouldn't just secret whatever Coulson became to a series of safe houses, risk everything and everybody on the dimmest of hopes. Crazy, mission-driven personalities that struggle to form relationships have equal difficulty letting them go after they do.
So, while I apologize for the subterfuge, I'm not sorry about what I'm doing, Coulson tells them. And, looking over to Clint and Natasha, he says more quietly, or that I intend to keep doing it. Natasha says something disgusting in Hungarian at him. Steve looks horrified.
Stark snaps his fingers. Translate. Capsicle, translate that, he demands.
That was unrepeatable, Steve assures him, favoring Natasha with an expression that is torn between awe and revulsion.
Nat loves getting that look. She also loves trolling people into getting that look by accident. Coulson used to say it was Clint's own fault he got slapped so much during Eastern European ops, because he ought to know better than to use Natasha's suggested translations for anything.
Nice, Agent Romanoff, Coulson says, and turning back to Stark, he adds, but this would be a good time to get suspicious.
Stark stops snapping long enough to scoff.
Of S.H.I.E.L.D.? Because been there, done that, Agent.
Of everything, Stark, Coulson answers, ominous and too cryptic. But Tony seems to get it, because he just says, right, like that meant something. And when Coulson opens his mouth again, Clint knows with absolute certainty that they're about to be dismissed.
that Coulson's about to let his team kick the Avengers off his bus. Knifed Judd or not, they're still going to leave. And everything still balled up in Clint's throat will still be balled up in Clint's throat when they leave him on the runway. If Coulson has a chance to get his composure again, to cover up that sliver of vulnerability, then maybe it will always be like this. Uncertain, off-center, wrong-footed. Clint is okay with being disappointed, with realizing he's fucked up. He's used to being scared and pissed, but he's starting to think he deserves better than to live with this uncertainty. To let his time and the bleeding gut wound he's been carrying around trail off like an unfinished sentence. Bartons are bad fucking news. They've got dosing rods for dumb decisions, and in the whole sorry history of his life, Clint's made maybe 4, at most 5, good calls. He turned himself into S.H.I.E.L.D. He ignored the kill order on Natasha. He got himself a Katie Kate. He's got a dog. Clint's never been sure the entire time he's been in love with Coulson if it was the underlying foundation of the good he does or the biggest fuck-up of all. If Coulson leaves him here, Clint will never know. It must show on his face like a beacon or a fire, because Natasha squeezes his hand for his attention. When he turns to her, she's smiling. Clint doesn't know how he got so lucky, how he got it so good, that he, Clinton Francis, aw, Coffee Barton, has someone like Nat who will wink at him and whisper, "It's okay, just do it." And now, I think it's long past time for you guys to vacate the bus, Coulson says out loud, and over the sound of Stark's reflexive snotty comment and Steve's reasoned argument and Urban Outfitters asking, "Wait, AC, do you watch The Office?" Clint says, loud and clear and with no tremble in his voice, "I'm staying with you, sir." Scuttlebutt at S.H.I.E.L.D. has generated some tremendous stories for Delta. Clint's not-real-heroic refusal to shoot Nat on sight has, over time, transmogrified into something wild with lashing rain and lightning arcing across the sky. Something about Natasha's vulnerable, trembling red mouth or whatever. Clint's intimately familiar with Natasha's vulnerable, trembling red-mouthed mojo when she's pulling one over on rich dudes. She did not bother to do that with him. Nat likes the NC-17 rated version, where she and Clint had done acrobatic and gross stuff to each other while declaring their forever love. That's at least, if completely wrong, a little true. The stories about Clint and how he joined S.H.I.E.L.D. are in another league of fucking wrong. There's the one about Clint getting hired to cross off Nick Fury and getting his knee shot out by Coulson, how his fragile desperation for belonging had touched something inside Coulson's robot programming. No. There's the one where Clint's sleek kills had leapfrogged him to the top of the most wanted list for S.H.I.E.L.D., and how Coulson had chased him down across the world. Lots of fancy cars and near misses. Glib sass. So much no. There's the one where he's a hooker and gets requisitioned for an op. Guys, come on. Clint is 99% sure Sitwell started that one. When Clint was dragged, kicking and screaming, clawing at the ground, into S.H.I.E.L.D. forever ago, Phil Coulson was already a functional necessity at the highest operational levels. People used to tell each other, one time those assholes, stories, in the hallways at the S.H.I.E.L.D. Academy about whatever fucked up bullshit stuff Nick Fury and his skim milk shadow had gotten up to that week. As far as Clint was concerned, Coulson was a ghost, a nerd's wet dream of pencil pusher turned badass. And he hadn't thought much about it beyond thinking that the whole agency was bugfuck. He'd worked his way up from security clearance level scum. "Level zeros are not scum, Barton," Soleimani used to tell him, bleakly hopeless about his long-term prospects. To level 2. And another 2 years after that, level 3. The 2-3 jump is one of the biggest at SHIELD. 2s pull domestic detail, are assigned regionally if they're junior, transcontinentally if they're senior. Once you hit 3, they give you your wings. Clint figures if SHIELD gave you frequent flyer miles, then he would have free first-class flights for the rest of his life, with how many military transpos they put him on in that first year as an L3. A lot of it's a blur of, "Barton, get on the plane at 0400. We need you to shoot someone in Blargistan." Or, "Barton, get on the plane at 0200. We need you to probably shoot someone in Blargistan, but we need you to sit out in the 120-degree heat or -30 cold for like 8 hours until we make a call." It sucked, but at least now he was killing terrorists instead of waiting for their checks to clear. So, they could have, and might have, crossed paths on 2 dozen overseas ops. That shit show that Melinda May had been in, that got her called the cavalry forever and ever, amen. One of 100 diplomatic escorts. They could have been introduced at a pre-op briefing, Coulson handing out his meticulous prep notes and slanting Clint that grin of his. Actually, Clint had met Coulson for the first time during a fire drill. He remembers sitting at a desk, 14th floor, someone had told him was his for paperwork, trying to fill out paperwork, but mostly staring out the windows at one of those soaking downpours New York gets sometimes. His ribs hurt from a thing, and he'd fucked up his knee, just a little, on his last op, so the humidity was making him one giant ache. He'd been remembering being homeless during this sort of fucking weather, and how much it sucked when the light and alarms went off through the building. Other specialists had popped their heads up in the cube farm. "You're shitting me," clearly written across their faces, until the deputy fire warden of the floor, Melinda fucking May, had shouted, "Hey, shitheads, get moving." It was a goddamn fire evacuation, so the elevators were out. And Clint's mood was just awesome after limping down 14 flights of stairs into the summer monsoon, chucking it down over Times Square, the armpit of New York City. Less than 30 seconds outside of the building, his hair was pasted to his face. He was fucking freezing. The status of his ribs had gone from "bugging me" to "aw, fuck this," and his knee was threatening to crap out any second. He'd been trying to scrub the pigeon-flavored rainwater out of his face when the constant tattoo of it on his skull, in his shorn hair, had stopped. Clint had dropped his hands and stared stupidly at his soaked boots and the way there was a haloed absence of precipitation around him for embarrassingly long before he thought, "Umbrella," and noticed the sensation of someone, body warm, next to him. The first time Clint sees Coulson in person, it is embarrassing. It is a D-grade rom-com, a contemporary romance novel from Avon, and subsequently, Natasha's apartment. It is raining in New York City, and Coulson's holding a black umbrella over Clint's head in the downpour, slanting Clint that grin of his. He'd been in a dark suit and dark tie, and a white shirt dappled by rain. It would take a lot more looking before Clint would start to recognize the expensive stitching, the heavy silk of the ties, the narrow, colored pinstripes of Coulson's shirts. That day, he'd just been a plain-faced older man in a G-Man costume, holding an umbrella. And Clint had barely seen any of that for the sucker punch of his eyes. How crooked his smile. Clint can't explain how he doesn't remember anything handsome or specific about Coulson, and yet knows all at once, too, that the moment had left a mark on him, a handprint in wet cement. Clint thinks he mumbled something like "thanks," but he knows for sure that Coulson had said, "Agent Barton." This next part, he remembers real clearly, because Clint had said, "And who the fuck are you?" Because he was still pretty feral back then. The guy had let out a little huff. It'd taken another year for Clint to identify it as a laugh. "Charming," he said, and looking away, added, "Also, I'm guessing you haven't picked up your next set of operational orders yet." Clint had looked left and right to see who was listening, but they'd been banked by SHIELD agents, field specialists in black jeans and tack shirts, admin agents in off-the-rack suits, most of them looking pissed and bored and extremely fucking wet. Tucked shoulder to shoulder under the umbrella, it feels like they're apart, partitioned from the push and shove of Times Square, of their co-workers. Clint's never been quippy or fast. He was even worse back then. He'd said, "Are you being serious with me right now?" as the rain had slowed to a mist. Coulson's only answer had been to stick out a hand to gauge the potential damage to his suit before folding up the umbrella. And wasn't it funny that underneath it they'd been alone, and without it they were in a crowd, and said, already walking away, "I'll see you in the briefing room tomorrow, Barton." The next day, Clint meets Level 6 Senior Supervising Agent Philip J. Coulson. He slides a mission packet across the briefing room table Clint's sharing with a half dozen Level 3s. And Clint looks up from the neatly trimmed nails to the familiar watch, a pale shirt cuff, and a navy jacket on a long arm leading up to the plain face and slate blue eyes from the day before. The mission's in Hong Kong, and after the rundown, Clint lurks around the briefing room until everybody else filters out. Coulson's got a grin on his face when Clint slouches up to him and says, "So, Coulson, huh?" And Coulson had offered his hand. "A pleasure to meet you, Barton. I look forward to working with you." Clint had pressed their palms together, and it felt something cautious, something shy, something cupped in two hands, begin to flicker in his chest. So, after all the reflexive shouting dies down, after Coulson corrals him off to stare into Clint's face, like he's stricken with something tantalizingly like hope, it's easy for Clint to take his hand again. This time, it's just Clint's rough fingers and rough palms scraping over Coulson's narrower digits. His thick palm, feeling the muscle and bone and the faint thud of Coulson's heart pumping Coulson's blood through the delta of his wrist. "Clint, you don't have to do this," Coulson says, noble to the last. Perfectly level, but he's clutching at Clint's fingers as desperately as Clint's clutching at his. Clint's terrible at words, but he's good at this, great at reading the warmth of Coulson's hands. So it's easy to smile, to know to say, "I want to. I want this." And feel Coulson's answer in the touch of his fingers, the thrumming of his pulse.